Hundreds marched and rallied in Fort Worth this week, protesting SB 4, known by critics as the Show Me Your Papers law, as the city council debated the pros and cons of joining the lawsuit against it. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. Led by the tiny border town of El Ceniso, all of the biggest cities in Texas have joined the lawsuit, challenging the new state law targeting so-called sanctuary cities. All of the biggest cities, that is, except Fort Worth. KERA's Christopher Connolly reports on the protest and how Fort Worth City Council members wrestled with handling SB 4.
Opponents of SB 4 promised a day of action, and they delivered. Hundreds of people in red shirts marched through downtown, chanting, cheering, and drumming. At City Hall, Matachines stomped and twirled, decked out in bright feathers and beads, a traditional dance venerating the Virgen de Guadalupe. In speeches, religious leaders denounced SB 4 in moral terms. A rabbi said it's intended to destroy communities. An imam praised Fort Worth's diversity, and a priest prayed for the city council. School board president Jacinto Ramos spoke in political terms.
The passage of SB 4 reflects one thing. It's a sickness of xenophobia and racism at the heart of our politics. It is a sickness that has infected the political leadership in this state. And the undeniable symptom is this discriminatory and exclusionary right-wing law.
Earlier in the day, inside City Hall, members of the City Council had their own debate. In a briefing, Assistant Chief Ed Krause told them police have already seen a decline in people reporting crimes, afraid because of SB 4.
When victims or witnesses don't report crime, that leaves those criminals undetected to the police and leaves those individuals on the street.
Krause said the law would require the city to change its policy that prohibits officers from contacting federal immigration authorities. But, he said, officers wouldn't be forced to call them either. Mayor Betsy Price wanted to drive that point home.
Fundamentally, it changes nothing about our procedures for community policing or all types of policing now. Correct?
Correct.
Some council members spoke passionately against SB 4. Gina Bivens, who's African American, worries about racial profiling. Most cops, she said, are good.
But every once in a while, we have a problem, and it's been documented. And even though the laws say, you know, racial profiling is illegal, pardon me while I spit.
The council did not decide whether the city should join the lawsuit opposing SB 4. This was a briefing, not a formal vote. But the nine members' positions became clear. Four thought the city should join the lawsuit. Five of them, all white, did not. Most said it would be a symbolic gesture not worth the resources. Dennis Shingleton said no one should feel discriminated against. But, he said,
when we allow our citizens or our non-citizens to turn a blind eye to the law, then we have opened the door, in my opinion, to conditions that go toward an anarchy.
Outside City Hall, Rudy Moreno was disappointed. His immigrant family settled in Fort Worth. Entrepreneurs, he said, hard workers, taxpayers. Still, some are undocumented, and they're scared.
I mean, I have a family member that won't drive because they're like, oh, no, I'm not going to drive, and then I'm going to get pulled over. What am I going to do? What am I going to show them?
Moreno said the fact that Fort Worth is still debating while every other big city in Texas has joined the lawsuit makes him feel like his family doesn't count in City Hall. For Fronteras, I'm Christopher Connolly.
Now an update on the San Antonio human smuggling case that resulted in 10 deaths. 13 immigrants have been formally charged as material witnesses in the case. They were all in the sweltering truck that James Matthew Bradley Jr. was driving through South Texas. The immigrant's lawyer is Michael McCrum, a former federal prosecutor. He told Texas Public Radio all 13 people are being sent to area detention centers so they can assist the U.S. Attorney's Office.
I was horrified to discover that you put a person in a jail cell, restrict their liberty, when all you want them for is to be a witness.
McCrum says he plans to seek relief for his clients that want to stay in the U.S. after they assist the federal prosecutor. The truck driver faces a court hearing later this month. Turning now to California. San Diego County resettled more refugees than any other region in the U.S. last year. But the high cost of living and tight rental market there may have forced some new arrivals into a difficult situation. Three refugee families there claim a resettlement agency staff worker told them to falsify lease applications in order to find housing. Now they fear losing their homes. KPBS reporter Taryn Mento has the story.
Hi, Mohammed.
Hi. Syrian refugee Mohammed Abdullah says he spent his first month in San Diego living in two motel rooms with his wife and six kids.
Our stay at the hotel became long. There was no choice for the organization, and we just wanted to leave but didn't know where to go.
The organization, he says, is the International Rescue Committee in San Diego. He says IRC staff placed his family in the motel while staffers searched for a permanent place. The IRC is a local resettlement agency that uses federal funds to cover housing and other needs for up to 3 months after refugees arrive in the U.S. Abdullah says it took 35 days to find him an affordable two-bedroom in El Cajon. He says he was happy with the space, but just before Abdullah went to sign the lease, he claims an IRC staffer stopped him and said not to show his family's U.S. government papers. The documents provided to KPBS identify all eight members of his family by name, date of birth, and photo. But a review of his lease shows not all of them were listed on the rental document.
She told us not to show the IDs because we didn't register your full family. We registered six people, not eight.
He says the staffer told him it was cheaper this way, but it could also be breaking landlord rules and goes against federal occupancy guidelines that the IRC has said it follows. The government recommends two people per bedroom plus two additional occupants. That means only six people in a two-bedroom. A family of eight should be in a three-bedroom. Abdullah signed the lease, even though it was missing two of his children's names. The document says any occupants not disclosed could be considered a material violation.
At any moment, any minute, they can kick us out because of this lie. This is a serious matter.
A five-month KPBS investigation found other refugee families living with more people in their apartment than appear on their lease, which is a potential deal-breaker. Three families claim IRC staff directed them to sign the inaccurate rental documents in order to get them into smaller and therefore cheaper apartments. The three families arrived late last year following a surge of refugees when new arrivals rose from an average about 250 a month in the early part of the year to three times that number by the fall. The IRC's San Diego affiliate declined an interview about these cases. But in an email, the local executive director denied his staff purposely omitted information on rental documents. He said their policy is to list all occupants on the lease. The IRC's national office sent KPBS a statement saying in part, "We are concerned about these reports and are investigating the situation to establish the facts." The federal government gives agencies like the IRC about $1,000 per refugee to cover that person's basic needs for their first few months. Finding affordable housing in San Diego can be tough for any low-income resident, but particularly for refugees who arrived with no credit and may have large families. University of Chicago lecturer Jessica Darrow studies refugee resettlement. In a phone interview, she said resettlement staff may have just been doing the best they could with what they had.
If that's the only solution that the refugee resettlement worker thought they had to offer the refugee family, then we aren't giving these refugee resettlement workers enough resources to work with.
Darrow says although federal funds have slightly increased over the years, she claims they haven't kept up with needs. Her paper on resettlement in Chicago found caseworkers at one agency routinely sacrificed housing quality for affordability. Mohammed Abdullah says he's still worried he could get kicked out of his apartment at any time. If that happens, he's not sure what he would do. But there are community members out there who are helping.
Taryn Mento of KPBS brought us that story. Now to the border. Foreign-owned assembly line factories known as maquilas that line the Mexican side of the border from Tijuana to the Gulf of Mexico have been bracing for change since the election of President Donald Trump, but not in the way you might expect. They don't fear the possibility of the U.S. withdrawing from the North American Free Trade Agreement. Instead, American maquila operators want NAFTA to change, saying it currently gives Mexican exporters to the U.S. an unfair competitive advantage. Marfa Public Radio's Lauren Madelon reports from Reynosa, one of the largest concentrations of maquilas on the border.
First off, a definition. Maquilas are foreign-owned factories in Mexico that produce goods for export. They sprung up like daisies in the spring after NAFTA took effect in 1994. They leverage low labor costs in Mexico and duty-free access to the U.S. market. They make everything from cell phones to computers to furniture. Now, in 2017, you'd think maquila managers might be worried about the Trump administration's threat to withdraw from NAFTA. Not so.
NAFTA's 30 years old. It hasn't kept up with today's economy.
That's Mike Myers, a Texan who heads a maquila run by Metal Industries, a Florida company that makes vents for air conditioners.
We paint it, pack it, and ship it.
After the U.S. election, some maquila operators flirted with the notion of increasing production to have more inventory on hand to export before any border tax was imposed on imports from Mexico. That tension has eased. House Speaker Paul Ryan said recently there's no support on Capitol Hill for a border tax. But maquila managers like Myers do say NAFTA was written in a way that penalizes American maquila owners.
Again, it was negotiated with different sets of rules on both sides of the border. We have to spend a lot of time and effort making sure we're 100% compliant with the Mexican government in order to be compliant with NAFTA.
He's talking about a mountain of paperwork, and that's not a metaphor. A lot of it's on actual paper. Myers must show Mexico that all raw material he brings in from the U.S., steel, aluminum, screws, bolts, leaves Mexico as finished product. That's how he gets duty-free access to both markets under NAFTA. But he says the paperwork Mexico demands is far more than what the U.S. asked for to show NAFTA compliance when his finished goods are shipped north.
If we're renegotiating a treaty, we ought to try and simplify things like that.
Maquilas matter for both countries. American consumers pay a lot less for products they routinely buy. And in Mexico, the manufacturing economy's been transformed by maquilas under NAFTA.
They're very important.
Ken Green's a Mexico specialist at the University of Texas at Austin.
If you look at the industrial workforce in Mexico, most of the growth is due to employment in maquilas.
There are other NAFTA details maquila owners want changed. Keith Patridge is the CEO at McAllen Development Corporation. That's a nonprofit group that works with American-owned maquilas.
Right now, the CBP, Customs and Border Protection, hours of operation for trucks does not match the hours of operation for the Mexico aduana.
Aduana, Mexican customs. Patridge says those different hours of operation translate into money lost for U.S.-owned maquilas.
Companies are more and more looking at really fast turnaround and delivery, and logistics is the name of the game.
There's something else on Patridge's radar. The digital age was just beginning when NAFTA took effect. Patridge and the maquilas he represents want an updated NAFTA, but they want it to scrap paper certification in favor of digital documentation. I'm Lorne Madelon in Reynosa, Mexico.
Coming up on Fronteras, a daughter reflects on growing up with her artist father, Juan O'Gorman, a master of mosaics and murals.
He always would tell me, you're not famous till you die.
We'll explore that story and meet some new citizens when we come back. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras. 11 West Texas residents recently became U.S. citizens at a naturalization ceremony at Fort Davis Historic Site. Elizabeth Trovall was there for Marfa Public Radio.
Midland dietitian Redora Pugao has been waiting for this day for 20 years.
I feel that this is a very nice birthday gift for me.
Originally from the Philippines, Pugao says that besides her son, she's the last of her family to become a citizen. Pugao took off work from her job as a diabetes educator to come to the naturalization ceremony in Fort Davis. She says she's happy to become a citizen, though her day-to-day won't change much.
Basically, I'll still be doing what I've always been doing. I'm a law-abiding citizen anyways, so I'll still pay my taxes.
Pugao is one of 11 West Texas residents to take the Oath of Allegiance today, the final step in the six-month naturalization process. New citizens also come from Mexico and Nigeria. Chief Park Ranger with the National Park Service, John Heiner, spoke at the event.
Probably would guess there's not one of us here that couldn't tell an immigrant story about our own families, right?
Arsenio Gomez's story started in Guadalajara, Mexico. Now he works in construction in Crane, Texas.
Estoy orgulloso.
Gomez says he's proud to become a U.S. citizen and that he's looking forward to working on improving his English. Since the start of the year through end March, U.S. Citizen and Immigrant Services approved more than 14,000 naturalization applications in Texas. Sweet. In West Texas, I'm Elizabeth Trovall.
This summer, San Antonians have been enjoying the rediscovery of an enormous mosaic in front of the Lila Cockrell Theater downtown. The mosaic is part of the legacy of Mexican artist Juan O'Gorman. To get personal insight on the artist and his iconic art, Texas Public Radio's Jack Morgan talked with O'Gorman's daughter, who watched her father create his masterpieces.
60-something Maria Carstensen is a proud grandmother who lives in San Antonio. She has a deep connection to that O'Gorman mosaic, beginning with her unique childhood.
Well, I'm Juan O'Gorman's daughter. I grew up in Mexico City, and I lived in the cave house in the Pedregal.
The Pedregal is a southwest Mexico City neighborhood where the ground is mostly volcanic rock. And you heard right. She lived in a cave house.
I think it was a small one, and then he dynamited it to make sure it wouldn't collapse or there weren't any issues. And then he did a lot of mosaic on the inside of it as well.
As a young child, Maria didn't think her living situation was unusual, even though cave living provided some interesting challenges.
And lava is very porous, so when it rained, we had buckets all over to catch the rain. But I never thought it was anything different because that's where I lived.
Architect and artist Juan O'Gorman was a man of international reputation, so young Maria's life was peppered with fascinating cave house guests, like the first man on the moon, Neil Armstrong, and the first lady and her husband.
Lyndon B. Johnson came, and I remember coming home from school, and there were a lot of bodyguards all throughout the yard on the walk up to my house.
But for her, nature held more interest than art. She remembers playing with friends and hiding among lava rocks outside her cave home, though she does recall a large, colorful Mexico City mural by her father.
The one that he talked a lot to me about was the bank mural in Mexico, because I'm in it. There's a drawing of me in it.
It features a landscape where commerce and nature combine seamlessly, and in the far right, a young Maria stands holding a document. In that Mexico City mural, she's about the same age she was when her father created the designs for the mosaic featured in San Antonio's 1968 World's Fair.
And I want to say about 11 when that was going on, and I remember going out to where they were putting the mosaic in the meter blocks and watching that, and they shipped them up like that and then put them all together, kind of like a puzzle.
Catherine Nixon Cooks, the author of Juan O'Gorman, A Confluence of Civilizations, which details the mosaic's creation.
Maria, his daughter, tells a great story of him having piles and piles of colored stone in the patio of the cave house. And as a little girl, she and her friends would go out there and jump in the stones.
O'Gorman and a workman assembled more than 500 of those meter square blocks, cementing more than 400,000 individual rocks, creating a mural which tells a specific and highly detailed story.
Moving towards the middle, you see math, you see science, you see what the Western world has contributed. And then on the other side of the mural, you see the allegorical Aztec gods. And then as you move towards the center, you've got this unified confluence, which is really quite wonderful. And running beneath it all is our San Antonio River.
For nearly 50 years, though, this massive piece has stood just far enough off Market Street in the shadow of the Henry B. Gonzalez Convention Center, hidden.
It was not seen by many, and I think that is really going to change, and I'm very excited about that.
With a portion of the convention center now torn down, The Confluence Mosaic is finally in the line of sight for thousands of daily passers-by. Maria Carstensen, the daughter who at 11 watched it all come together, welcomes the change. She recently paid the mosaic a special visit.
I went with my grandson's field trip from his school, and I did a little presentation about the mural using big posters, and then I had a slideshow, and they really enjoyed that. And then they had a field trip down there, and I went with them.
Carstensen says her father thought artists' rewards don't always come in their lifetimes.
He always would tell me, you're not famous till you die.
It seems now O'Gorman is finally getting his due in San Antonio. A confluence of civilizations was the theme of the 1968 World's Fair, and given that O'Gorman's father was Irish, his mother Mexican, it was also the theme of his life. In a larger sense, Confluence of Civilizations describes what most San Antonians live every single day. Jack Morgan, Texas Public Radio News.
That's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced this broadcast. Michelle Dubac is our executive producer. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.